Kitty Weston Naur is a woman who knows a few things about overcoming adversity, lessons that have come in handy in her 30-plus years of work with at-risk students. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kitty Weston Naur spent 33 years working for the Des Moines Public Schools, first as a teacher and later on as a principal of an alternative high school. During that time, she also became one of the first competitive female BMX bike racers in the nation. 18 years ago, a bike accident left her paralyzed, and she was told she would never walk again. Today, we'll talk about the accident, her path to recovery, and her work in education. It's also the first day of our shortened three-day membership drive here at Iowa Public Radio. This is listener-supported public radio, so please take a moment today to support the public radio station you depend on at iowapublicradio.org. The news is next. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Kitty Weston Naur spent 33 years working for the Des Moines Public Schools, first as a teacher and later as a principal. During that time, she also became one of the first competitive female BMX bike racers in the nation. 18 years ago, a bike accident left her paralyzed, and she was told she would never walk again. She not only walks, but still competes and is still making a difference in the lives of students and teachers. She's an adjunct professor at Drake University, working with student teachers and with her educational consulting firm, KWK Enterprise Incorporated. She has just overseen the development of a new public charter school in Des Moines. Good morning, Kitty.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
You spent much of your career with the Des Moines Public Schools at the Scavo campus, an alternative high school. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, Scavo campus, okay. Which is the alternative high school. That's
right.
Correct.
When you got into teaching, were you particularly interested in working with at-risk students?
You know, I can't say that I was. To begin with, I was not familiar with alternative high schools. When I began my career back in 73, I was a English and language arts teacher at Merrill Middle School. And I was there for 13 years. And so I only knew the middle school age students. I then became the vice principal at Callanan Middle School. I was there for a number of years as the vice principal, and then I moved on to be the principal of Cassidy Alternative School. Now, that particular school at the time was located on the near north side, 16th and Jefferson in Des Moines. We also had the alternative school, which was at that time, it was called South Alternative, but that was where Scavo Campus was originally located. And then in 99, the two alternative schools were merged into one, and it became Scavo Campus, and we were located at 1800 Grand. And so I was there from 99 until 07 when I retired from the district. You're asking if this was something that I had wanted to do or thought about doing. I think the way my career was going, other people saw in me the ability to work with these types of young adults. And so I just kind of fell into it. But it was a love of working with these young adults that really kept me engaged with these students and with the community.
Well, I want to talk more about your work with students in a few minutes, but somewhere along this career pathway, you started riding BMX bikes.
Right.
What got you interested in BMX bikes?
Our oldest son, when he was second or third grade, a friend of his said, you know, you might want to come out to the BMX track and see what we're doing. BMX is a very non-traditional sport. People look at it as an extreme sport. We wanted our children to engage in the types of activities that were as non-traditional as possible. And so, you know, he went out to the track, loved it. Next time we went out, he brought his bike. He had a Huffy at the time. And we borrowed a helmet. And the rest was history in terms of this young man. he was able to be extremely competitive against students, other kids his age. Being the typical parents that we were, we became more involved in the sport, more so as parents as opposed to actually racing. And we began to travel just within the state of Iowa. At the time our son was involved in this, there were 7 different BMX tracks in Iowa. And trust me, we would pack up the car on a Friday and we'd hit a Friday evening race and a couple of races on Saturday and another race on Sunday just in Iowa. You know, the more he was involved in it, the more we said, you know, this is really fun. It's truly a family sport.
Well, let me go back to, you said you wanted your kids to be involved in non-traditional sports.
Correct.
Why was
That's
that?
The reason is that when we typically think of sports for students, for kids, it's the typical balls, basketball, football. At the time, soccer was coming into its own, and he actually played soccer and was pretty good at that. But what we wanted was for him to try to engage in those kinds of sports where he could be as competitive as he wanted to be and did not necessarily have to rely on teams.
So you wanted more of an individual sport.
You know, in a sense, swimming would have been one. And we actually tried that, and he wasn't a swimmer. Golf was not an interest of his at that point in time. Cycling was, because as a 7-year-old, he did his first rag bri as a 7-year-old.
Wow.
He would have done it at age 6, but I didn't know that little kids did rag bri. He had begged to go with me that very first year, and instead he spent the week with his grandpa. That following year, that young man had his own bike and was out there doing rag bri and did 11 consecutive rag bris clear through high school. So, as I said, we wanted him to engage in activities where he could really develop and come into his own. So that's how we got involved in the BMX.
So how did you make the transition from being track parents
right.
to being out there yourself?
You know how it is as parents. We want our kids to just go and give it their all. And I'll never forget at one point, we're standing on the sidelines in Rockford, Illinois, just yelling at Max about, you need to pedal. You need to do this. You need to do that with that bike. Pass that kid. And he said, Mom, if you think this is so easy, why don't you try it? Now, you know, I love a challenge. I really do. Of course, the only parents who were actually engaging in that sport at that time were fathers, or I didn't know of any other women. And so actually my husband got involved at first, and I kept saying, you know what, I am not about to keep doing this and watching somebody else having a good time. And so we got another bicycle that I then began to ride. As a matter of fact, my involvement was competing against my husband also because we're in the same age class. The reason is there was no woman's class.
Sure.
And so I began to become as competitive with the sport as my husband was and with other men. And we began to travel throughout the country. I ran into one other woman who was in our age class. And she and I, whenever we were at the same races, got to compete with the men. So that's how I became involved in the sport.
So you were there, obviously, with your son, with your family. You'd been a part
Yes.
of this scene for a while, but still, you're a professional African-American woman. You take Yeah. up BMX bike racing. Yeah. How did people react to that?
Well, of course, I'll tell you, women secretly marveled at what I was doing.
Probably some of them not so secretly.
Well, some of them not so secretly because they did let it be known that this was for kids and this was for men. But I tell you, I came from a very competitive family. I had 5 brothers and 2 sisters. And I was the oldest daughter. I had 2 older brothers, and then I came along, and then all the others came after. And, you know, I used to tell people there was nothing my brothers could do that I couldn't do better. And I went about making sure that that was the case. I learned to play every sport possible, from track to softball, and actually it was baseball because I had my brothers I had to play with. And, of course, when it came to football, I loved that sport because I would get in there and mix it up with the fellas. Marbles. Loved playing marbles. As a matter of fact, I still have the marbles from my childhood. And my brothers didn't like to play with me because I wound up with their marbles. So I've always been very competitive in nature. And it didn't matter to me that other girls were not involved in the sports. That was not what it was about. What it was about was me beating them, whoever them happened to be. And, of course, there were other guys.
Right. So this was really just a continuation of what had been going on your whole life.
Exactly.
What kept you coming back to the racetracks? Why was competing in this way so satisfying to you?
You know what? As an educator, one of the things I made it a point to always tell my students, learn something new every day. In this day and age, you will forever be a lifelong learner. And what I really enjoyed about being out there on the track was it allowed me, and it continues to allow me, to learn. And I had to, because competing against, especially against the fellows, because that's all I had to compete against, they made it a point to let me know that they were not going to allow me to just win. So I had to find ways to best them. You have to understand a BMX track is similar to a motorcycle motocross track, with the exceptions of it's a very smooth track. It's not a chewed up track. So it's a very hard dirt track. The turns are banked. They are berms as opposed to just turns. And one of the things that I continually learned to do out on that track was, which line should I take when I go into a turn if I'm racing with other people that will put me in front of them? So you learn to go high-low on a turn or low-high on a turn such that you will come out in front of them. The other thing is coming out of the starting gate. How do you put yourself in a position when you are in gate 8 to wind up being among those who are podiumed, that is first, second, or third? And so it's a matter of how do I get the best gate start that will put me ahead of the others? It is constantly learning about the art of racing. And so every time I'm out on that track, I'm always trying to find out how I can become better and better as a racer.
How did your sons, both of them, I don't know if your second son also got involved in this, but how did they react to your throwing yourself into this sport?
Well, because we were all traveling together, I never heard, and our youngest son never got involved in the sport. Our oldest son was the only one. He really relished in it because, you know, people would make comments about your mom's out there on the track. And he said, oh, yeah, she's really great. The other thing was I use my son to teach me. Mind you, he's much younger. I use my son to teach me some of the strategies that I needed to develop in order to become a better racer. What a unique way of being able to really connect with your child. And I use these same kind of connections within my education in terms of teaching students. I always told students, I don't always have the answers. And as I got older and as technology began to flourish more, I had even fewer of the answers. And what I've always been able to say to my students is, we are learning this together. And so for my son and even for my husband, who became very much involved in the sport of racing himself, it became a family affair, where we worked with one another to become stronger and better racers. And this proved out when our son at age 11 was the U.S. champion for his age class.
That's fabulous. There was a time, though, that that was very difficult in your racing history and in your life 18 years ago when you had an accident on one of those
yes.
bikes. What happened?
This was in Rantoul, Illinois. As I said, we traveled all over. And I was actually practicing for the race that was to come about in about an hour. And I had been learning how to jump doubles. Now, you know, kids get on the bike and they just get out there and they just jump. Well, I was a bit older at 40, you know, at 42, I wasn't exactly this, actually 44, I wasn't exactly this little spring chick anymore. And so I'm out there learning how to jump. Kids have been showing me how to do it. I'd become kind of good at it. But, you know, you have to do it correctly if you're going to be successful at it. And unfortunately, I didn't level my pedals as I went over this double. My right foot was in a downward position. My left foot was up on the pedal. And the pedal hit the dirt. The bike, of course, stopped. I'm doing about 20 miles an hour as I'm making this jump. The bike, of course, stopped. I'm still in motion. I flip over on the left side of my bike and hit my head. Now, I'm fully geared. I have on all of my safety equipment, helmet, gloves, leathers, the whole nine yards. And I just hit the ground incorrectly and wound up crushing the disc between the fourth and fifth vertebrae, which lodged up against the spinal column, and it caused instant paralysis. I remember when the medics got to me, they asked me if I could get up, and this was my response. I still remember this to this day. I said, if you help me get my legs down, I will be able to stand up. And at that point, they said, don't move her, because they knew. My last sensation, of course, was flipping off of my bike and my legs in the air. The rest in terms of that was history, because it was determined that that yes, I was paralyzed, that I could not move any of my extremities from the neck down.
Wow.
And so that happened on a Sunday, and I was taken to Carl Hospital in Champaign, Urbana. The neurosurgeons there said point blank, if I cannot find the neurosurgeon that I want in Des Moines, you will remain here and you will be here for at least 6 weeks, because we have to do surgery and then we want to make sure you're on the path to recovery. We can't guarantee you anything. We don't know if you'll ever walk again. And I said to myself, you know, I was in the best shape that I had ever been in my life. And that if this surgery was successful, I was walking out of this hospital. They did find a neurosurgeon here in Des Moines. I was transported back to Des Moines on a Wednesday. The neurosurgeon saw me on Thursday, had already determined that they would be, and actually when I came back, they had determined that Thursday they would do that surgery, because I saw that neurosurgeon at Wednesday. And he again said, you know what, we don't know what your chances of recovery are. They had actually slated me to go to Yonkers Rehab, which was at Methodist, and the surgery was being done at Mercy. And I told him that I'm walking out of this hospital. And the neurosurgeon said to my husband, she really doesn't understand the severity of her injury. And my husband said, I don't think you understand this lady. If she says she's going to do something, she's going to do it.
Well, we will leave it there for a moment. We're going to take a break, and we'll find out what happened after surgery in a few minutes. My guest is Kitty Western-Nauer. She is one of the first competitive female BMX bike racers in the nation and a longtime educator in the Des Moines Public Schools. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Kitty Western-Nauer. She spent 33 years working for the Des Moines Public Schools, at first as a teacher and later as a principal at a number of different schools in the public schools there in Des Moines. She also, during that time, became one of the first competitive female BMX bike racers in the nation. She has recently been recognized by the website The Griot as one of 100 history makers in the making in the class of 2011, and she has a truly remarkable story. We were just talking before the break about an accident, a bike accident that occurred 18 years ago. Kitty, you were riding your bike. You flipped off the bike and crushed the disc between your fourth and fifth vertebrae. This Correct. Pushed up against your spinal cord. And where we left it, you were in the hospital facing surgery. The doctors Right. weren't giving you much of a chance of ever walking again. And you refused to believe that.
Yes. Growing up as a child, we were often told from other people, you know, you won't be able to do this, or you can't do that, or don't count on certain things. But my parents, who were both educators, made it very plain and clear that there was not anything that you could not achieve if you did several things. You didn't just set your mind to it, but you worked very hard to make sure that it came about. Didn't matter what the circumstances might be or the situation at that point in time. And that's something that I've always taken with me throughout my life. And so now I'm in a position in my life where I'm told that I might not walk again. And I knew that, as I said, I had been in excellent health. I mean, I had been working out and doing the kinds of things that have kept me healthy and very strong. And facing this particular adversity, I just said point blank, not me. I will be walking again. As a matter of fact, I will be back on that bike again at some point in time.
But, you're thinking this, you're laying there in a mm-hmm. hospital bed, you can't move your sure. arms or legs. There must right. have been moments of doubt.
I'm not going to say that there weren't. But I refuse to let those moments of doubt override what I knew could happen if that surgery were successful. Okay, if the surgery was successful, I was going to do whatever was in my power to overcome that. Now, here's the other thing also. We don't do anything on our own by ourselves if we really stop and think about life. And I knew that there were many, many people involved in helping me towards recovery, and I was going to do whatever it took to get beyond that.
You had the surgery.
Yes.
What happened next?
Really interesting. My mother came to be with me, and she had come from at the time she was living in New York, and so she came from New York to be there with me, and I remember coming out of the surgery, you know, you're really groggy and foggy and you don't remember a whole heck of a lot. But I do remember the neurosurgeon saying he would be coming in Friday morning to check on me. And I guess I mumbled something to my mom and to my husband about, well, in the morning I'll have a surprise for him. And lo and behold, Friday morning when he came to the room, and of course everyone is wanting me to take it easy, be careful, we don't want anything else to happen to you, I was standing up.
Wow.
He walked in the room and I was standing up, and he says, "I can't believe this." And I said, and I'm still kind of groggy and foggy, but I was in an upright position, and I remember saying something to the effect of, "I plan to walk out of this hospital." And he was just amazed because he said he'd never seen anything like this before.
How long were you in the hospital?
I think I was there for about a week. And during that time, of course, they began to get me involved in those pieces of recovery that allowed me to. They didn't allow me to walk out. You know, they never let you
right.
walk out. They
right.
wheeled you out.
Yep.
But I made it a point to follow the directions, engaging in, of course, the recovery aspect of it, where I was working all limbs. And I want you to know, it truly took about 2 years to get total feeling back in my feet and in my hands and arms. And for years, And it was more than 2 years that I continued to work to be able to put my arm as far down my back as I could, you know, just to do some simple tasks. I had to learn how to walk all over again. Actually, I had to learn how to crawl to walk because that was all a part of that process. It's a matter of retraining your muscles, getting those nerves to respond appropriately. And so this occurred in August. It was October before I was able to go back to work. And I was determined I was going back. At the time, I was the vice principal at Callanan Middle School. And so I did everything in my power such that I could go back walking. And I did. I did. I actually was back on my bicycle that following spring because I had determined that I was not going to be afraid of riding again. I did not want that to get in the way of who I was.
There are people who would hear that and think, that's determination, that's bravery, but maybe that's also foolish. How did you reconcile that with it? You know, here you have injured yourself terribly doing something
right.
that, yes, you love
mm-hmm.
to do.
Right.
But you went right back to the same thing. Why
of
was
course.
That so important to you?
One of the things that I learned as a child that I imparted to our own children and with my students is that just because something happens to you doesn't mean that you stop doing it. Okay? Plain and simple. I love the sport of BMX. I had become so involved that I had worked with the national organizations, and there are two of them, to really look hard at developing women's classes. Why should I, as a competitor, not be able to race against other women? And here's the other thing that happened as a result of my accident and my getting back on that bike. Other women said, you know, you may be a little crazy, but you got something going here. Why shouldn't I, as a female, get out there on my bike? After all, I'm bringing my kids to the track all the time. I love the sport, too. Why should I not become competitive? And so as a result of that accident and going through my years of rehab, because once again, I'm on the bike before people say I should be, other women began to take note of the fact that this was something that they could do. Here's the other thing I did. I knew what caused my accident. I was trying to learn how to jump. And you know what? To be competitive, I don't have to jump. As a matter of fact, a smarter person keeps the bike on the ground, wheels on the ground all the time anyway. And so I was determined that as I continued to get back into that same form I had been in as a competitive racer, I wouldn't jump anymore. And I don't jump. I don't go out purposefully saying I'm going to jump that double or I'm going to jump that tabletop because I really don't need to do that. In other words, I found an alternative way to continue to truly engage in the sport of BMX, still love it, and still be as competitive.
How long did it take you to actually start competing again?
Well, as I said, that following spring, because that happened in August, and by April or May, I was back out on the track again. I had no reason not to be. I mean, I was walking, talking, back to work full time, and really missing, truly missing the racing aspect of the cycling. So I was back out there by that April or May.
You weren't just back out there riding your bike. You were back out there in races that April
yes.
or May.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes, yes. And keep in mind, even though I was not finishing first, second, or third, I was still working towards being as competitive as I had been prior to the accident.
When you went back to school as a vice principal after that accident,
mm-hmm.
did that change how you related to the students that you interacted with?
Very much so. You know, this was truly a time in my life where I said to myself, I will not accept excuses about why either my life is like it is or why I can't do something. And this is the same attitude I took when I began to work with my students again. Of course, youngsters always have an excuse for why they can't do something or why something is not their fault or on down the line. And one of the things I would say to students is, you know what? I have a story that I could tell you that would have you crying, would leave you in tears. Now, let's talk about it. And I shared what had happened to me. And kids would say, and you went back to race? I said, my point exactly. Now, here's what I need to make sure you understand you need to do so that you can continue to be successful. Granted, things have not been hunky-dory in your life. Things are not as you want them to be in the classroom. But let's talk about some ways that we can help you to transform that so that you can become successful as a student in the classroom and in your life.
How did kids react to you?
You know, it's real interesting. One of the things that I found was the students became even more interested in the sport of BMX. Not that they were out there doing it, but would always have conversation with me about how I was doing as a competitive racer. And that enabled me to really form a connection, a bond with students. Because here's the thing. Students want you to be interested in them, in their lives, but they also want to be able to share that interest with you. And one of the things that I have always found very important and the reason for my success with students is a connection. They want to know that people care about them. They want to know that we are concerned about them. And in the same way, we as adults want to have students to care about and have a concern about us. So it worked both ways.
It's interesting. When you say that, I think about the relationships that I had with different teachers over the years. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, as an adult now, when I think about kids, of course, my life is wrapped up in work and in right. my children. But right. it sounds like because you were a BMX racer, you were able to find something outside of the adult world.
Yes.
That you
and that's important.
With them.
Right. It is, that is so important that we do that. And it is that connection that enables you to then help impart that kind of, they could be strategies or skills or ideas or what have you. But I find that our kids are much more willing to listen when they can form that connection with you.
You have retired from the Des Moines Public Schools, and
yes.
now you are an adjunct professor at Drake Green University, which is your alma mater.
Yes.
You're working with student teachers, with
Correct.
Students who are becoming teachers.
Yes.
What can you teach them about connecting with students and beyond the mechanics of being in a classroom?
Right. You know, it's more than about the having that information about the curriculum that they are necessarily teaching. You really need to be able to listen, to understand, and to just have conversations with kids. And it's more than my just teaching them. It's being that sounding board, because not only do I go in and observe our students, but we have seminars where we have an opportunity to talk about what's working, what is not working, what they can do in terms of making those adjustments as student teachers in this learning process for them. What I really like about it is listening to what they have to say and then sending it back to them. What is it you want to have happen? And how would you suggest going about having that happen? It's not about me saying, well, you know, I could just give you the answer, but rather providing that environment in which they, as a group of young newbies, young about to be teachers, have an opportunity to share their own experiences. And then the question always comes back to me, of course, in terms of, well, okay, so then what is it that you would do? I simply share some of my experiences with them. But the other thing I always want them to know and understand is that it's not how I've done it, but rather how do you see yourself in a particular situation and what is it that you want to have happen? I think that's really important that they are able to come up with not just an answer, but a solution to whatever the concern may be.
Teachers who are in training right now are entering a different world than you entered 30-some odd years ago.
Yes.
You know, of course, there are lots of things that a lot of challenges for teachers right now.
Yes.
There's a lot of pressure on on teachers. There's a lot of pressure on school reform right now. There's not a lot of money to go around. As you look at these students facing today's challenges, what concerns you the most?
What truly concerns me is that we still do not think of educators as professionals. It is the single most important job that anyone could ever have outside of parenting, where we are preparing our children to take their place in this world and to do it in a manner where it is that our children will be able to continue to live in a world that just is so fast paced and just changes all the time. But we want our children to take our place in a manner where they will be able to make it an even better place for all to live. And educators are not only teachers, they are parents, they are coaches, they are psychologists, they are trainers. They are everything rolled into one, and yet, at least in the United States, we haven't yet figured out the importance of educators and education. There was a time when a student did not necessarily have to graduate from high school. We know in this day and age, a student not only must graduate from high school, but must continue with some type of post-secondary education. And our teachers must be trained not only in the curriculum area that they're teaching, but also in all those other areas such that they are molding these young people to be the best that they could ever be when it comes to graduation.
I'm sure that among the students that you work with, you have many idealists who come into the profession feeling just as you do. And this is the most important job outside of parenting that somebody can do. At the same time, they are going to be in the trenches. Being a teacher is an extremely difficult job.
Yes.
They're not going to probably get a lot of public recognition for what they do. They're probably never going to become wealthy because of what they do. So what can you tell those young idealists who really want to make a difference in kids' lives to keep themselves motivated through all of the difficult work that they're going to be doing?
Right. First of all, as I have my conversations with my student teachers, we talk about life and the world, and they understand that they are not in this to make money, but they are in this to make a difference in the lives of youngsters. As long as they are able to stay focused on the eye of the prize, which is that student that they are working with, then they will do whatever it takes within their power to be able to make a difference. Granted, they will never have all of the resources at their fingertips, but here is one of the things that I talk to students about. Get to know the community in which you work. Get to know the parents of the students that you work with. And by that, I'm saying make those phone calls. Get involved in activities in the community that you can in turn go back and at some point in time have some conversations with those people and say, you know, these are the kinds of things we're doing in my class. And I certainly would love to have you come to my class and not only just have some conversations with some students, but how you can help to be a difference maker for the children in my class. You have to become involved in your community as an educator, such that you are saying to that community, not only do I care about my children, but I want you as a community to help me to care even more for my for the children with whom I am teaching. It's not an easy task. And understand this, one of the things we talk about is you take your work home with you because you're planning or you're thinking about some things to do differently with your students. You're going to be involved as an educator for the rest of your life. You will also be a lifelong learner, so you will continue to learn. Today's technology has proven that for us all.
You're not only still involved in education, and you oversaw the development of a new public charter school in Des Moines, but you are still out there racing bikes. And Kitty, if I've done my math right, you're 62 years old?
That's correct. I sure am, and loving it.
And you are right now the oldest female competitor in BMX bike racing.
Yes.
Why is it important to you to keep getting out there on the track?
As I said before, I love learning, and I want to stay competitive. The other thing is, this is a great way to maintain good physical and mental health. So that's the reason. You know, I'll be completing my 29th RAGBRAI this summer. My way of exercise for me, of course, is cycling. And I just think it's important to be an example for others. Yes, I am 62. Yes, there are comments about the fact that I'm the oldest woman out there. But here's what has happened during the time I have been on that BMX track. We have gone from two women. Now, girls have always raced, but typically by the time they become adults, they have given it up. We have gone from two women racing to over 700 competing nationally. I'm sure there are more than 700 who compete at the local levels also. But what I have seen happen is a growth and an expansion of this sport to the point where we now have our own classes. I no longer have to race with the men. Not that I didn't mind. As a matter of fact, they were happy to get me out of their classes simply because they didn't like the fact that I became so competitive that I was
beating them,
including
them,
yeah. My husband. Exactly. So you see, this has had an impact not just on me, but on the sport itself. That's in that it has been opened up to women, not just here in the United States. Women all over the world are competing in the sport of BMX.
Well, Kitty, I hope you're out there for many more years.
I plan to be, definitely.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Kitty Weston-Nauer spent 33 years working for the Des Moines Public Schools. She's now an adjunct professor at Drake University, and she also has an educational consulting firm in Des Moines, and she is the oldest female still out there racing BMX bikes in the United States. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Brian Dow, with technical support from Jonathan All in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Iowa's volunteer culture. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.